Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:31 p.m. and it is Wednesday, March 6, 2019. Before we begin, I want to thank Rob Montenegro, the House Judiciary Secretary, to make sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Wool, Representative Kopp, Representative Shaw, Representative Stutz, my Vice Chair, Representative Ledoux, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our topic for today is we're going to be getting presentations from invited speakers who either work with or serve on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. The first person we'll be hearing from is Captain Sean Case from the Anchorage Police Department, who will be on by telephone. Susan DiPietro, Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, who staffs the Criminal Justice Commission, and Quinlan Steiner, the Director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. We invited the Department of Law to participate, and we expect that we will hear from them in the near future, but they won't be testifying today. And so I'm going to go ahead and open the hearing for invited testimony, and the first we'll hear from is Captain Sean Case from the Anchorage Police Department. Captain Case, because you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound is sometimes not so clear if you're on a speakerphone. Go ahead and identify yourself, and you can begin with your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean Case, first is spelled S-E-A-N, last is C-A-S-E. There's kind of three directions I'd like to go with the things I want to present today, and the first thing has to do with increasing resources to make the current system work more effectively. The second thing is adding resources that expand the level of effectiveness, increase efficiency, and save money for the justice system. And the third is partnering with outside resources to meet the needs of those in the criminal justice system and reducing costs. So the first example is specific to the Anchorage Police Department in adding resources both to our patrol division, so it's officers out on patrol as well as detectives within the detective division, and specifically focusing on one area that has been extremely high in terms of rates of stolen vehicles. Since the beginning of February in 2018 to the end of February 2019, we've seen a decrease and the number of stolen vehicles by 66%. That number is quite significant, and when you look at how many those actually are, we're talking about 340 down to approximately 116. So those are the actual numbers. And in that effort, we've done around the clock investigations using the detective division, including them in the last 11 months, and 553 field interviews, resulting in 1,262 total charges. So, you know, that is an example of us kind of expanding the number of employees we have available to investigate those particular crimes. The second thing that I want to talk about is the use of social work clinicians in the field. We've had a social worker on staff with the police department for quite some time, working in a very narrow and focused area. And starting in January, we have started utilizing that social worker in patrol, specifically as it relates to mental health calls for service. In February alone, just to give you some basic numbers, the Anchorage Police Department transported 157 people to hospitals for mental health related problems. When we look at those calls with our clinician, about 15 of those were actually necessary to go to an emergency room type of setting. 137 of those could have been dealt with in the field with a clinician, and currently our clinician is going out in the field about 3 days a week, 3 to 4 hours a day. With just one, it's pretty limited. So when she's not doing that, she's reviewing police reports of all the activities that are involved. Of those 137 that could have been dealt with in the field, 65 of them, so roughly half of those folks could have been best dealt with by some sort of a stabilization center, so not the high-cost area of an emergency room. And the rest of them could have been field contacts in whatever setting we had contact with them, and then having follow-up with our social worker. The nice thing about this particular approach is that these types of services provided, particularly with a social worker, would be eligible under the Medicaid 1115 expansion waiver. So it is a cost-saving method that results in ultimately a better service that's provided to this particular population. And what we also see with this population is not only are they high use of the emergency rooms, but they are also high use of the Department of Corrections, because they result in a significant number of arrests as well. So it's kind of one of those trade-offs where we provide a partner up with a new resource that we haven't traditionally used in the past. That's going to get us a better result with that population. The third thing that I want to talk about is the use of field-level diversion programs. What I mean by diversion is diverting folks out of the criminal justice system. In about the last 6 weeks, the police department has taken four different individuals that were arrested for misdemeanor nonviolent crimes. And instead of using the traditional criminal justice system, we've diverted them by partnering up with outside pre-existing agencies, reentry resources, is the resources that we're using to house these folks, assist them in getting jobs, getting access to Medicaid, transportation. And in the last 6 weeks, four individuals that we've placed in this diversion program are still in that program today, continuing to be successful. And so this type of a diversion model, although it's not going to significantly contribute over the long haul to a decrease in crime rates, what it does provide is probably a better method of responding to the individuals that we've identified for this type of diversion model. And then it also allows the police department to be a lot more efficient, because these folks are repeat offenders or require a lot of attention from the criminal justice system and other entities that provide support for them. So I guess in sum, you know, what my objective here in testifying today is, you know, I'm not going to say that I support or don't support any of the crime-related bills. What I do want to suggest is that I think there are some alternate options out there that will either make the current system that we have operate more efficiently, like with increased resources, or more effectively by using outside resources that typically we don't think about using, particularly in the law enforcement field.
Thank you. I know we've got Captain Case is here for somewhat limited time because he's got other stuff, but questions. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Captain Case, for testifying. And I'm pleased with some of the things you just had to report. The decrease in auto theft, I think you said 56% over the last year from February 18 to February 19, which are pretty impressive numbers. Can you attribute that to anything in particular? I know, that's, I guess, my first question.
Through the chair. So I'm not going to jump out on a limb and completely take 100% of the credit in the police department. There's multiple factors as we talk about crime rate, for sure. So, you know, the increased enforcement with adding officers in the street and the increased investigation with detectives, without question, I can say that contributed to such a significant decrease. Was it completely responsible? No. I mean, there's other factors that are involved in that system. The Anchorage District Attorney's Office has been extremely helpful in prosecuting those particular cases, so that leads to it. We've had legislation changes that have also contributed to that. So there's a number of factors, but the increased enforcement and investigation is certainly a part of it.
follow-up?
Thank you. Yeah, to your second point, using social workers in the field and reducing the number of people that either enter emergency rooms, or if I guess what I think I hear you're saying is some of these people aren't requiring necessary police intervention and aren't requiring a police solution, i.e. through the criminal justice system or even to the emergency room, but if there was another type of facility, of which there's probably limited capacity, to take people that aren't really in need of a criminal treatment, but more of a medical, because you mentioned Medicaid. So it's almost more of a taking a medical type person and having a medical type solution, non-emergency room. Do you see this as filling a bigger role in the future?
Absolutely. So the medical response model, we can use that not only for mental health, but also for those people that have drug addiction as well. And when I talk about the possibility of using the 1115 waiver, the social worker, the services that they provide, the contacts they have with these individuals, that would qualify under the waiver if we did utilize that in Alaska. And so if we were to expand having these clinicians available, which isn't a model that would just work in large urban areas like Anchorage, because some of these clinician contacts can actually occur over the telephone, which makes it a lot more accessible for some of our rural areas as well. And so that would be a system that would help pay for itself, not 100%, but it certainly would lower the cost of having that sort of service. And it would keep them out of the jails, and it would keep them out of the hospitals, so we'd have reduced costs in those particular areas. So I think this is something that it's been tried in other states very effectively, and I think something like this could expand and work throughout the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Captain Case? Captain Case, I don't see any other questions here from the – I'm sorry. Representative Ledoux has a question. I didn't see her. I looked right at her and didn't see her waving her hand at me. Go ahead.
So, Captain Case, can you give me an idea as to – what sort of calls the social worker would go out in, and previously where those people would have been taken?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I can give you a lot of examples, but I'm going to give you something that occurs on a very regular basis, because unfortunately when we talk about mental health calls for service, we kind of always go to that Title 47 model in our mind. But many of the mental health calls that we go to don't qualify under Title 47, but that's the only tool we have. So, for example, we get a call where, let's just say the sister calls in about her brother who's threatening suicide. And we show up and we talk to the brother. The brother's got some alcohol on board, not having a good day. When we talk to the brother, he says, hey, look, I don't want to harm myself. And I got in an argument with my sister. I said some stupid stuff, but, I'm fine. And we talked to the sister, and the sister is in tears because she fears that her brother is going to take his own life. That's why she called. She wants some form of intervention. And the intervention that she can get immediately is a police officer. And so even though that person, the brother, doesn't 100% meet the requirements of a Title 47, the only thing we can do with that person is, if they committed a crime, arrest them or take them to an emergency room setting in Anchorage as proud psych and admitted them on a police officer committal. And that's using resources that are not necessary for that particular individual. And what we found is when our social workers out in the field, they can engage with that individual. They can deal with the immediate acute situation at the time. We can leave that person in place, and then that social worker also provides resources for that person and then follow-up for them later, which is the best level of care that we can give them in that particular situation, and far better than taking them to the emergency room.
Thank you.
Representative Shaw has a question. I know, Captain Case, you were on limited time, so I'm going to let Representative Shaw get the last question in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Case, more curious than anything else, my major question is, how are we doing so far? And a part of that comes from the point you brought up about prevention. It seems like that might be a new direction, because we've gone with policing, prosecution, incarceration, and prevention seems to be a direction that's really benefiting the entire policing program. But I guess in a nutshell, where are we on the results to date on Alaska Natives being released? And are there fewer people in jail for the crimes that we stopped incarcerating for? I don't know if that's an odd question, but if you could follow up on that, please.
Representative Shaw, through the chair, I will tell you that there may be someone testifying after me that probably will be able to give you a little bit better answer on all of those questions. I will tell you that one of the concerns we have had as it relates to, you mentioned Native population, and I will just expand that to any minority population or population that is living in poverty. We've seen historically through the years some disparities with those particular populations within the criminal justice system, and any way, anything that we can do within the system to not make a one-size-fits-all criminal justice system, so we can meet the needs of the population, because different individuals within the system require different responses. I will be completely in favor of that, and that is certainly the direction that I can tell you that Anchorage is going, without question.
Thank you, Captain Case.
And Representative Shaw, he's correct. The papers you have in front of you and the slides up above are the next coming next.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Captain Case, thank you very much for. There's one question that I just want to ask. In Anchorage, have you seen any other criminal offense categories that have seen a drop similar to car theft since the passage of Senate Bill 54?
Mr. Chairman, no, and I would say that from our, we've done all sorts of things to try to positively impact the community, but in terms of enforcement action, where we've really put a lot of resources on one specific area, vehicle theft would be that area. I mean, there's other areas across the board. We certainly have not seen a decline in any other area to the extreme of stolen vehicles, and we've not increased our dedication of resources in any other area as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time, and appreciate your being willing to be first up. That brings us to our next invited testimony, which is going to be Suzanne DiPietro from both the Alaska Judicial Council and staff to the Criminal Justice Commission. And what I am doing on all the presentations is giving the presenter a chance to get through their presentation, and then we'll take up questions when the presentation is over. Just let us know who you are, even though I keep repeating it, and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and the Judicial Council staffs the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And I'm here talking to you in that capacity as staff to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. So the chair had asked me to give a little bit of background. Some of this will be repeat information for some of you, but it may be new for others, about what were the problems that led to criminal justice reform, what reforms were undertaken, and then a little bit of new information, because the commission is keeping track of how things are progressing with data pursuant to statute. And we have a little bit of information for you on that, and I'm going to provide that to you today. So real quick, the reasons for reform, and this is going back to 2015. The first issue was unsustainable prison growth that had been increasing faster than the population growth over the past decades. Alaska was actually approaching prison capacity, and there was a prediction that we would have to build a new prison as early as 2017 if those rates didn't slow. The second issue really was that we weren't getting such a great outcome for our public safety dollars. So I think you all probably have heard of recidivism figures, and that recidivism is simply the rate at which a person who has been incarcerated and who has been then released actually comes back into incarceration for some reason, some kind of transgression or wrongdoing. And there are a variety of studies have been done, but a good rule of thumb is to understand that, you know, about two-thirds of the people who were released from prison would come back within the first 3 years. So not a very good value for the public safety dollar. And then the third thing was really a feeling that there needed to be a sort of a fairer justice system. And this was kind of this came in two flavors. The first information that the commission had was about pretrial detention. So that is, once a person has been arrested and charged with a crime, the first question that the judge has to decide is whether that person can be released on bail while their case is being resolved, or whether the person will be held in incarceration, detained until the case is resolved. It's a very important first question. And under the old system, that question was resolved in large part by the person's ability to pay a money bail amount. And that didn't seem fair, since the ability to pay is not necessarily linked to a person's risk in the community. And then also, well-documented information about racial and ethnic disparities in incarceration and in pretrial detention. So these are things that are very concerning, and the commission was very concerned about those. So real quick, just to give you, I mentioned that the prison population was going up. This chart shows it, 27% in a decade. And then this shows a corollary that might not surprise you, which is that spending on corrections also was increasing. And these spending amounts are based on inflation-adjusted numbers, for those of you who would pay attention to that. So let me now talk about that second tranche, which is the recidivism. And this slide, which I'm sorry is pretty busy, gives you the results of a number of different studies performed by the Alaska Judicial Council on this issue of recidivism. And it gives you sort of an idea of the range of time frames and percentages of people who are released from custody who then return for either on a violation of their probation or because they've committed a new crime. And when the commission was looking at the data, it had this information that misdemeanants actually have a higher rate of return to incarceration than felons, but that felons also had a high rate of return, and that the rates were highest among youthful offenders and those with more serious prior criminal histories than Alaska Native and Black offenders. So this all goes into the category of not getting a very good return on our criminal justice dollar. So then that third tranche I mentioned was the fairness issue. So the commission did a study on pretrial detention of Alaskan defendants in 2015 and found that only about half of people who were arrested and charged were actually released during the pretrial period. In other words, only about half were released before their case was disposed. And so we were keeping a fair percentage of people who are charged detained pretrial. And yet, of those who were released, about 37% were actually rearrested during the pretrial period. So we weren't releasing very many people, but the ones we were releasing actually were not having a very good performance during the pretrial period in terms of being able to not get rearrested. And then I also just want to cite to you, there is an Alaska Judicial Council report. It's quite lengthy. It was published in 2004. It involves felony defendants who were sentenced in 1999. And that report documented racial disparities in predisposition incarceration, so that if you are an Alaska Native person, you are more likely to be detained pretrial. And that is controlling for other factors, not all the other factors you could think of, but controlling for the most obvious other factors that you could think of that might account for that. So, for example, controlling for the defendant's prior criminal history, controlling for the severity of the charge, and so on and so forth. So it's quite a robust finding. I'll move on to the next slide. So this is sort of, I went through that pretty quickly. So I just want to sort of go back and reiterate the main takeaways. So we weren't getting such a great return for our criminal justice dollar because the recidivism rate was pretty high. A decent percentage of people who were charged with crimes were sitting in jail waiting for their case to be concluded, and the ones who were getting out were actually getting rearrested, a fair number of them. Also, this chart here shows something that I didn't mention, but over half of all inmates were nonviolent or supervision violators. So when we think of people sitting in prison, we think of people serving a sentence. Well, this pie chart here shows you that actually people who had been convicted and were serving sentences, many of them were convicted and serving sentences for nonviolent crimes, and many of them were supervision violators. And what is a supervision violator? That's a term that the commission uses to refer to somebody who's been incarcerated, has been released on probation, and then comes back into the facility because that person has broken a rule of their probation. So not committed a new crime necessarily, although they sometimes do that as well, but broken a rule of their probation such that the probation officer has put them back into incarceration. Also, the commission had information that on the issue of supervision, that some of the supervision practices used by the probation officers throughout the state were inconsistent in different locations, and there was room for improvement in terms of the focus of their practices and their caseloads. So now I'm going to go through what actions were taken in response to these identified problems and why. So the first thing that was done, as of course you all know, is that the pretrial release system or the bail system was changed quite significantly. The laws were changed so that the laws that judges use to decide whether a person should be released were changed to make it easier for a person to be released if they could show that, provided that the judge found that they were not a risk to the community and that there was not a risk that they would fail to appear for a hearing. And also, pretrial enforcement division was created in the Department of Corrections. And that division has officers, correctional officers, in a variety of locations throughout the state who are available to be assigned to supervise people who are on release. So if the judge finds that he wants to release the person, he or she wants to release that person pretrial, but thinks that that person could benefit from a little oversight, the judge can assign a pretrial enforcement division officer to supervise that person. So what is the outcome of the some of those reforms? Well, you know, we are measuring sort of what were the ethnic disparities in pretrial detention before and after the reforms were undertaken. So as Captain Case alluded to, you know, a lot of factors are at play, and we can't say for sure what causes what, but certainly we are seeing, and this is from a study that the Alaska Judicial Council completed, or it's actually not even complete yet, this is a study that has preliminary results, that it looks as though the disparities in pretrial release by ethnicity have decreased for Alaska Natives. So it is closer to the case now that Alaska Natives and Caucasians who are charged with crimes and are considered to be released or are released, that the differences in those release rates are closer than they used to be. I mentioned the pretrial enforcement division. I just wanted to give you some information about how the pretrial enforcement division is being used by judges. So about half of the arrestees that the Judicial Council studied in this study that it did in 2018 were given a PED supervision order by the judge. In other words, the pretrial enforcement division was told by the judge, hey, we would like you to supervise this defendant. So that is quite a few defendants. That is quite a high utilization rate of the pretrial enforcement division. So they are out there supervising quite a number of defendants, at least from the sample in the study. Now, I should also add here, the sort of provisional results of this study. I want to remind everyone, I'm sure many
of you... I would just note that Zach, Representative Fields has joined us in the audience. Please continue.
I want to remind everyone that these pretrial reforms did not go into effect until January 1st of 2018. They have not been in effect for very long. That makes it difficult to give definitive answers about what's really happening on the ground, right? Because people are being have been subject to the system for such a short amount of time. Their cases haven't even resolved yet. So we have a number of people in this study whose cases are still open, and we can't say what happened to them. So that's why the results that I'm talking about now are so provisional and should be taken really as sort of encouraging results, but not should not be taken in any way as final results. And the reason I am presenting provisional results to you is simply because this is an important issue, and you know, to the extent that we can be somewhat confident of how the study is going, I'd like to share it with you. So I do have a caveat on that. Also, I want to let you know that the University of Alaska Justice Center is under contract with the Department of Corrections to revalidate the pretrial risk assessment tool. I didn't talk about pretrial risk assessment too much, but it is part of the bail reform package, and it is an actuarial instrument that was developed by researchers specifically for Alaska to help judges and lawyers identify the relative risk level of people who are arrested who are being considered for pretrial release. And that tool, which is a statistical tool, needs to be examined and revalidated after a certain amount of usage, and that is exactly what is happening right now. So this will be the first return of data on that. Hopefully by, as I understand it, early summer of 2019, we should have a little bit more information about how that's going. So now I'm going to talk about some of the trends in the prison population related to sentencing reforms. So first of all, the commission's sentencing reforms were recommended at focusing prison beds on serious and violent offenders. Remember that slide several slides ago where I showed that many of the people taking up prison beds on a given day were nonviolent offenders. And there were several reasons for this, and it's important to remember why this was a recommendation, because longer stays in prison, the studies show, do not give better outcomes than shorter stays. And I think that's just the most important, one of the most important principles that we can remember. And what is the reason for that? Because for many offenders, particularly low-risk offenders, spending lengthy amounts of time in prison can actually do what? Make them worse, actually increase the rate at which they reoffend when they are released. And this is something that we really should try to avoid. Other information is that custodial sanctions give better outcomes than non-custodial sanctions do not give better outcomes than non-custodial sanctions. What does that mean? That putting somebody on probation supervision can be more helpful for their rehabilitation than putting them in incarceration. And the way I like to think of this is that we would really not necessarily want to spend too many beds of our expensive prisons on who we're mad at, but probably more we should spend those beds on who we're afraid of. So what has been happening with the ratio of violent to nonviolent prisoners, and this chart shows that a little bit, we've seen a few little changes in that, that the percentage of violent offenders is increasing compared to the nonviolent. So that is what we would be expecting to see. I can also tell you, because the question might come up, that the prison population has been going down. So this just has percentages. It doesn't have the actual numbers on it. I also wanted to just touch on admissions for drug crimes, because that's something that we've all been looking at. And as you probably know, one of the important parts of criminal justice reform was to take drug possession, what we would think of as maybe simple drug possession, even though that's not that term isn't used in the law, but a person who's possessing drugs for their own use or maybe to share with friends as opposed to a dealer, that type of behavior used to be a Class C felony, and it's now a misdemeanor. And the reasoning there is that for people like that who are possessing for their own use and maybe to share with friends or maybe even to sell on a very, very small scale, that those individuals have a drug problem and that they can be better addressed with treatment in the community than they necessarily will be addressed in incarceration. So this chart just shows that we have increased, as you might expect, the number of incarcerated drug offenders charged with an A misdemeanor. Those are the possessors, and decrease the number who are charged with the C felony. Those would be the distributors. And this is another way of looking at admissions, and I don't mean to get too technical about it, but you can, when you're talking about the prison population, you have to remember it's changing every day, really every minute. And so you have to think of ways to measure that makes sense. And there's kind of two ways that the commission uses, and that with DOC's help, has helped the commission to understand. So one thing you can look at is on a snapshot day, how many beds are being taken up at any given time by certain types of offenders. And the other way you can look at it is who's coming in. So every time a person is arrested and booked into a facility, there's a record for that. And if they're released and then arrested again, there's another record for that. And so on and so forth. So this is, that's what we call the admissions data. So this shows that admissions for violent offenders have been fairly steady, as we might expect, since the idea is to reserve the prison beds for the violent. And the admissions for nonviolent offenders at the beginning of the criminal justice reform process had started to go down, and then actually started to go up a little bit, and then after the passage of SB 54 started to go up a little bit more.
Question.
I know I'm going pretty quickly, so I do apologize for that.
We'll get a chance to go slower when the questions begin.
Okay, so, and then the last thing I just wanted to briefly touch on is supervision reforms. So I've been talking a lot about supervision violators and people on probation, and I want to explain that the reforms to the way we treat people who have been incarcerated and are now coming out and returning citizens, reentering the community, was changed by criminal justice reform. And so here's some information. So the commission was really wanting to strengthen supervision and interventions to reduce recidivism among this population, because remember, about two-thirds of them were ending up back in prison within 3 years. So within that three-year subset, though, the commission found that most failures would be happening within the first year of release, and actually many within the first 3 months of release. And so the idea there is to what do you do about that? So the reform was that we need to sort of front-load our resources for these people when they first get out, and that would be offering reentry services. That would also include increased supervision and assistance from the probation officer right when the person gets out, in this form of swift, certain, and proportional sanctions. And then also giving the probation officers some more concrete tools in terms of trying to get these individuals to change their behavior, to use not just sanctions, but to use rewards and incentives. And some of the very interesting research from the criminal justice field is that incentivizing, in other words, offering a person a reward or an incentive to do something right, is in many, many instances a more powerful way to change their behavior than sanctioning them for doing something wrong. I don't know, for some of us that seems a little strange when I think about it. Of course, many of these people are people who've been sanctioned repeatedly. They spend a lot of time being sanctioned in a variety of ways by a variety of systems. And the idea of having a reward or an incentive, even something as simple as verbal praise, can be very powerful. So probation officers were given a system of administrative sanctions and incentives that they could use in sort of on an informal basis to quickly reward positive behavior and correct negative behavior. If the issue rose to the next level and the officer decided that it was necessary to go to court to get an incarceration sanction for bad behavior, the way that was accomplished was to create caps on what we call technical violations. So the first time a probation officer would file with the court a petition to revoke probation saying that the person had violated the rules of probation, for example, by drinking alcohol when he was prohibited by the judge from doing that. The first time that might happen, the probation officer could file that petition right away. The person would be arrested and put in jail for 3 days. And this method of sanctioning was different than the way that it was done before, because before, the probation officer might wait until the person had done several things wrong, sort of hold those petitions and then file them all at once. And by the time the whole thing got to adjudication, which would be about a month later, the court was, these violations had sort of stacked up, and the court was imposing significant terms of incarceration in the range of, you know, 90 or 100 days on average, which is sort of, you're doing it, you're not responding immediately to the bad behavior. It's not certain that each instance of bad behavior is going to be responded to. And when you do get a sanction, it's a big one. So it's just completely not the right way to change a person's behavior. So the idea is that the sanctions that are delivered by the court will be swift, certain, and proportionate. Also, a key piece of the reform was to, again, on this theme of incentives, to let probationers who were in compliance earn credit off the length of their probation. And the commission actually just at its meeting on Monday heard some data from the Department of Corrections that about half of probationers have been able to earn that compliance credit. And I think there's going to be more testimony about that, but certainly initial days, it is looking as though that ability to earn that credit is proving to be a very effective provision. So what that does, what does that do? Well, it allows the supervisees who can comply, who can do what they're supposed to do, to more quickly get off the probation officer's caseload, so that the probation officer might have a reduced caseload that contains more of the people who are medium and high risk, more of the people who just cannot seem to get it together, who need more attention. And so that is exactly what criminal justice reform was intended to accomplish, and there is evidence that probation officers' caseloads are actually shifting more towards the medium and high and fewer of the low-risk offenders. And in addition to that, probation and parole discharges, successful discharges, I should say, have been increasing. So these are people who have gotten off probation successfully. And it's not to say that they might not have done something wrong along the way, but they have managed to complete all their requirements and been discharged. And then I want to give you, this is sort of a global idea of what's happening now. So on the left, you'll see the chart that has the legal status of supervision violators in FY15. So you'll see about 20% of prison beds on a given snapshot day in 2015 were taken up by these supervision violators. But now we see, with more recent data, that actually that's now shrunk to about 14%. So we've managed to really decrease the use of expensive prison beds by these supervision violators while maintaining a system of swift and certain sanctioning. I just wanted to quickly mention victim reforms that were contained in criminal justice reform. And the first one is about the requirement that a prosecuting attorney at the victim's request confer with the victim of any felony before entering into a plea agreement. Prior, that was only a DV crime or a sex offense. Also, the court at the time of sentencing now informs the victim about the sentence or the release of the person of the offense and the potential for release on furlough, probation, or parole, so giving an idea to the victim about sort of what's going to happen towards the end of that person's prison term. The parole board is now giving more victim notifications and the opportunity for the victim to provide input pursuant to statute. There were clarifications in there about enforcing protective orders from other jurisdictions. And the last one is actually one that we're seeking to get some data on, but probation officers now are required to create a restitution payment schedule for people they supervise. And restitution is a very powerful tool, not just for restoring a victim who's been harmed, but it can be a very powerful tool for rehabilitation of an offender who can then, once they've paid the restitution, feel that they have taken some small step, not a complete step, but a small step to making amends, at least financial amends for the crime. I'm going to quickly go through some crime trends because this is something that people often ask about. So this is a 30-year crime trend rate. So this is adjusted for population from 1976 to 2017. And this is only the violent crimes listed there, homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. So as you can see, over the past 30 years, although there have been squiggles and dips and ups and downs, that in general the trend line is that violent crimes have been increasing in Alaska, unfortunately. And actually that crime rate really, in terms of numbers, is really driven by aggravated assaults. I pulled out also from that prior chart, I pulled out what are called in the federal reporting requirements rape crime trends. We would call it sexual assault. And also this shows that I think what most people know, but the trend line for rape also has been going up. Again, squiggles, ups and downs. You know, you might ask yourself, well, what happened? Why did things go down here? Why did things go up there? It's super complicated. Look, you know, trying to pinpoint, you know, what causes crime. A lot of this even could be what crimes people are reporting. So it's very complicated. But anyway, the trend line, as you can see, is up. And then there's a vertical pink line there in between 2013 and 2014, and that's when the federal government revised the definition of rape to make it more inclusive. And since then Alaska revised also its reporting, and its rates actually have even increased there. So any kind of a steep change right after that revision, you know, you have to remember could be related to the revised definition. And then here's the trend for property crimes. Interesting. Again, this is the rate of property crimes, not the absolute number. So it's adjusted for the population. And again, we see squiggles, ups and downs, but in general, it has been going down. The all-time low was in 2011. You might ask yourself what happened in 2011. And then I want to just put up here in conclusion, the former and current members of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, who have worked so hard, who have studied the data, who have looked at the national studies, who have pored through the Alaska studies, who have met, who have debated, and who have made their recommendations with incredible good faith and hard work. And I hope that when you see some of them, you will thank them.
Okay, questions?
Chairman.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, and thank you, Suzanne, for that excellent presentation and for all the hard work of the Criminal Justice Commission over the years to help us tackle these important issues. Question is about the increased rate of successful release from supervision. Do you have... I noticed FY16, we're at 65.7% successful probation parole discharge, and FY18, we're up at 88, so that's over, that's 23% improvement. What do you attribute that significant increase in success to?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, you know, I can't say for sure, but I certainly think the earned compliance credit incentive has a lot to do with it. The ability to earn, for the person who's not committing violations, to earn a shorter time of probation and be discharged more quickly. I think it also has to do with the sanctioning and incentive structure that DOC's been using. And as I, I don't know for sure. I wonder, though, if the probation officers, as they get more used to the system and start to be able to use those tools more effectively, that we might just be getting, frankly, better at it. That would be a couple of ideas that I would have.
Okay, follow-up, Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
You said the, without giving us any data, you said the pretrial enforcement division, since its inception, and the data that we do have looks encouraging, but there's nothing really to talk about until the summer of 2019, this summer. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes. Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair. You mentioned a pretrial assessment tool and that it's being recalibrated. So that leaves me to believe it's actually like a little maybe handheld computer or computer of some sort that you plug information in and then they tell you what the outcome is. And can you give me a little more information on what that pretrial assessment tool might be?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I breezed through that way too quickly. So it's actually being revalidated. The way that I can understand this is when you go to apply for your car insurance, your insurance company will look at certain characteristics of you and will give you a rate that they're going to charge you for car insurance. And they're trying to make a prediction of what is your risk of getting in a car accident. So an actuarial pretrial risk assessment tool, which is what we have in Alaska, is trying really to do that same thing. It's based on research, so you would not want to just sort of choose a characteristic out of the air, like everyone with blue eyes, we're going to give them low car insurance rates. No, you're going to look at how many crashes have they had in the past. You know, who knows? I actually don't know what they look at. But we do know what the factors are in Alaska that are predictive of pretrial failure. And those questions or characteristics of a person are assessed in the pretrial risk assessment tool. I don't know, I can be more specific on follow-up if you'd like, but they are assessed by the tool, and then the information is presented to the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney, and they look at the information about the person's risk of pretrial failure, and they use that information when they discuss the bail situation, and the judge considers the information when he or she makes the bail decision.
Thank you. Follow up?
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. Do you know, do other states use that?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, yes. Actually, a number of other states use pretrial risk assessment tools. No one uses Alaska's because that was developed exactly for us. But Washington, D.C. has been using pretrial risk assessment tools for, I think decades. There are a number of municipal and state systems that use them. There's been quite a bit of research recently on these tools and their ability to, I think the bottom line with these tools is that they are not the answer. They are not going to give you sort of the magic eight ball out, you know, prediction. But what has been shown over and over and again is when you combine the results of an actuarial pretrial risk assessment tool with the professional judgment of the people in the courtroom, you get a better and more accurate assessment of risk than you do without the tool.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And through the chair. So I was curious, my first question was on this slide, when we're talking about main takeaways for.
Why don't you tell us which slide that is?
I wish I could, but there's no number on it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wish I had put numbers on it.
Is there any kind
reasons
of.
Reasons for reform.
Okay.
It's up now. And I'm just curious, obviously, when you receive a conviction, oftentimes it's more than for just one offense. How did you deal with multiple offense convictions in this data?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it's actually quite a tough situation for the analysts, because there are a number of charges usually, at least a couple usually. So what we do is we take the single most serious charge. And there is a rubric for deciding which is more serious in general, and, you know, almost all violent offenses are going to be more serious than nonviolent felonies, generally more serious than misdemeanors.
Okay. And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Through the chair. Now, you mentioned the 66% recidivism figure at 3 years, and I was curious, how much higher did that 66% go, you know, when that study was done, if you drew it out to, say, 5 years?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I am not off the top of my head aware of studies that go out in the general. Actually, the Department of Corrections does have some data on that. I don't have it off the top of my head right now. Normally, 3 years is the window, but in general, if you're using a cumulative recidivism rate, it gets bigger every year, generally speaking. Although, interestingly, after 5 or 6 or 7 years, it then tends to drop off again.
Follow up, and I, Representative Eastman, I will not, and for the committee that we did hear from Department of Corrections, I would expect we'll get the corrections in with some of their recidivism data here within the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman, with your
Curious to know, so under this recalibration of the risk assessment tool, as we stand now, just could you remind me, is the charge with which a person is brought into custody, is that part currently of the risk assessment calculation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it is, in the sense that there is one question that has to do with, I think, number. I'm not sure. I'd have to double check my notes to answer that for sure. But what I can tell you for sure is that when Alaska was working with the researchers who put together the tool, the current charge was one of the factors that they measured to try to see, is that predictive of pretrial failure? And for whatever reason, during that analysis, because often it is, in some other pretrial risk assessment tools, it has found to be predictive or predictive enough to include. But in that analysis, it was just it just did not rise to the level of good enough predictability to include it in the tool. Was it completely not predictive? I couldn't say. But you know, there's a winnowing that has to happen. You have to take the factors that are the most predictive, and that just didn't come up. It just didn't rise to the top. And we've talked about this with the researcher, and she said specifically, we should check that again when we have more data, because what's happening? You know, the system isn't static. The types of crimes being committed are changing. Perhaps the types of people committing crimes are changing. We don't really know, but the system we know for sure is not static. Well, what does that mean? That's why we revalidate, because now we want to look again. And I don't want to speak for the Justice Center, but I'm virtually certain that the Justice Center will be looking at current charge and saying, hey, let's look at this. Is this predictive? Now we have way more data, way more recent data, and if it is predictive, I would expect them to suggest that it be included in the tool.
Okay, thank you. Follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So, on the admission slide here, we can look back as far as fiscal year 15, quarter one, and I know the current number where we're at in fiscal year 18, quarter four. Seems to be higher than anything else on the chart. Do you know how far back do we have to go till we have something that was higher as far as admissions for violent particularly than where we're at today?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I can't answer that right off the top of my head, but I can definitely, we could get back to you on that.
That would be great.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. And final follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
And then you mentioned here on the supervision reforms slide, the rewarding probationers who comply with their conditions by allowing them the extra 30-day credit. And so we talked about that reward. Two-part question. So, one, if you're rewarded for, you know, complying with your conditions, you know, generally speaking, what are the consequences if you don't comply, other than not being rewarded, of course? And then what were the other rewards that you were kind of referring to that are at their disposal or options?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. So some of the I think your first question was what, other than not getting, other than failing to earn the earned compliance credit, what are some other ways that a person could be penalized if they're not following the rules?
Just what are you seeing as far as what's being done now? What are those penalties that are?
Actually, we just had a through the chair, Representative Eastman. The commission just had a presentation on Monday from the Department of Corrections on some of their sanctioning data. And as it turns out, the Department of Corrections, probably their most frequently used sanctioning tool is arrest and filing of a petition to revoke probation. I think you also asked about what are some incentives that can be used. Based on the presentation we had from the Department of Corrections on Monday, verbal praise actually is, I know that sounds quite strange, but verbal praise is actually a very effective incentive tool. The probation officer who was with us characterized it as catching somebody doing something good. And so that's actually the number one incentive tool that the probation officers use. But there are other things. So, for example, the probation officer might adjust the person's curfew, let them stay out an extra hour. The probation officer might let them associate with people that they before had said no, might decrease the frequency of drug and alcohol tests. Whatever, you know, if the supervisee can show that they can sort of not violate, that they can do what they're supposed to do, that the incentive, part of the incentive structure, can be decreased supervision, because the supervision can be quite, you know, intrusive and onerous, and the, you know, it looks as though the probationers are really responding to those incentives.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux, or I'm sorry, Representative Shaw is up next, then Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Suzanne, I notice on the pretrial enforcement division that it makes recommendations to the court regarding release decisions. That means that the recommendations, there are no issued mandates to the judge?
Through the chair, Representative Shaw, it's a very good question. So the officer does make recommendations, but the judge does not have to take those recommendations. Where the pretrial risk assessment tool, the results of that assessment come into play are in the statute that describes the judge's options for imposing, for example, money bail in certain situations, and it has to do with what type of crime the person is charged with and whether they're low, medium, or high risk on the risk assessment tool. Generally, those are the two variables that the judge works with to decide what kinds of conditions he or she will impose on the person's release, whether it be monetary bail, supervision by PED, requirement for drug and alcohol tests. So the judges have a laundry list of things that they can put in place, require the probationer the arrestee to do before they will be released, and the way they can use those tools is governed in some degree by the charge and the risk level.
And Father, just a note, Representative Shaw, your question actually also had a historical component. When the first Justice Reform Bill passed, Senate Bill 91 in 2016, that actually part of the structure for those recommendations actually limited the judges, or took some of the judges' discretion away in the first iteration. There were a number of questions about that in House Bill 312 that passed last year that was changed so that in every instance the judge has the discretion to reject that recommendation and treat bail as they see fit. So part of your question, I think, was based on history. And your impression that it was different early on is correct, and what Suzanne DiPietro just explained is the current status.
You answered my follow-up question. Thank you.
I didn't mean to answer the question. Okay, Representative Ledoux.
So, Ms. Pietro, what do you mean exactly when you talk about pretrial failure?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Ledoux. I should have defined that more precisely. Pretrial failure is defined, it has two elements. Number one, failure to appear for a court hearing, and number two, committing a violation of your conditions or a new crime. So getting arrested for either breaking the rules of your release or committing a new crime.
Thank you. And then I've got one other question.
Representative Ledoux.
So one of the concerns before Senate Bill 91 passed was that there were people who were sitting in jail simply because they weren't able to make bail. So I was kind of wondering, what percentage of those people were adjudicated as not guilty?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, so your question is, of the people who were not released pretrial,
yes,
how many of them had all their charges dismissed or just some
of
their
charges? I guess what I'm trying
to... Or they were acquitted.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, so if somebody was sitting in jail because they couldn't make bail, but then their charges weren't either dismissed or they were acquitted, I mean, if they were convicted or they pled or something like that, didn't they get credit for that time anyway? So that it really wasn't such a travesty of justice that they might have sat there before because they got it, they got credit at the other end.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, that's correct, that once the judge imposes the sentence, any pretrial incarceration time would be sort of credited against the sentence. The commission had, though, also information about those pretrial status defendants. One of the they're a difficult population to manage. Why? Well, first of all, they have to be moved around to court hearings. So that's actually a difficult management issue for the Department of Corrections to get all the people who need to go to court on a given day to court on that given day. They're moving them around among facilities. The court is, you know, I want to say faxing. It's probably not faxing, but the court is sending over lists of hearings and defendants, and they have to be matched up to the people at the facility. So it's a management issue. Also of concern was the fact that for a person who's in pretrial detention, the facility doesn't have a good idea of when they're going to get out. They could get out tomorrow at their next bail hearing. And so it's very difficult to give them any programming. So are they getting, you know, substance abuse treatment? No. Whereas a sentenced offender might get substance abuse treatment. So your point is completely well taken. And I think the idea, though, was that we want to get these people into a sentence status so that they could be managed better and actually given programs to the extent that those are available and necessary.
Thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
I just note, I want to have time because Mr. Steiner is also going to present. So after Representative Wohl's questions, I think everyone's had a shot at some questions. We'll get Mr. Steiner up, and if we still have time after Mr. Steiner, we can bring Ms. DiPietro back.
Thank you. I have a few questions I accrued during the presentation, so I can edit as needed.
Not limiting you to one question.
Yeah, thank you. So this graph that says admissions, that had violent and nonviolent admissions, that one. It looked like nonviolent admissions were going down, mm-hmm, from 15 to 17. And then with the implementation of SB 91, they went up. And then SB 54, they went up some more. Isn't this contrary to what your goal was at the outset, which was to reduce admissions for nonviolent offenders?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I think that's probably right to say that the goal was to at least to decrease So again, it does go back to the way you're going to count things, and I hate to be overly technical, but it is kind of difficult to get an idea. So these are admissions. So these are people coming in, and so you could, for example, have people coming in and serving short terms and then going out and coming in again. That actually might increase the the number of admissions, while at the same time, on any given day, you might have fewer people sitting in a prison bed. And I'm really sorry
about
that.
We'll follow up.
Thank you. Well, that just, and I have more questions about that question. But
yeah.
So admissions, is that admissions into incarceration or admissions into the criminal justice system? Would that include pretrial as well? Or if that's, is that non-pretrial?
Through the chair, Representative Wold, these would include all bookings.
As distinct from an arrest. This is an arrest where somebody is taken down to jail, as distinct from somebody that might be cited and released on the street and not taken down to the jail.
Okay, through the chair, if I may, Representative
Wold. If I got those wrong, she'll correct me.
No, I just want to say that I have to remember, I do believe that this is all admissions, which would include pretrial admissions, but I think my staff, if hopefully they're listening, will text me and let me know if I'm wrong, if these are sentence admissions instead. But I do believe these are all admissions.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up,
thank you, or separate question altogether. It seems like recidivism numbers, the ones you gave us in the two-third range, 60-something percent, that 66%, yes, that does include violating conditions of parole, and I'm wondering if in the reform, the conditions of parole, I guess they're ordered by the judge. I don't know to what extent the policy of that is trying to be altered. In other words, has that been something that's been altered in trying to reduce the amount of people that violate their conditions of parole but don't really commit what would otherwise be a new crime?
Through the chair, Representative Wold, at the risk of overly complicating, there's parole release and probation release. Parole release conditions are determined by the parole board and probation by the judge. But I think your question was about probation, and those conditions are imposed by the judge at sentencing. And the conditions that a judge can impose at sentencing, nothing that I can think of in the law changed that. And there is case law, though, as you might imagine, where the judges, when they're imposing these conditions, they're doing so to further the rehabilitation of the defendant, of the convicted person. So they're really only putting on conditions that they think are going to further that person's rehabilitation and not just sort of other conditions that might be a good idea.
Follow-up. Thank
you. One or two more, and then I want
okay.
to get Mr. Steiner on before.
Okay, that's fine. I guess to that point, follow up on that one point, I guess anecdotally, I know of people that are, I don't know if it's parole or probation, because a lot of these are they don't go to trial, they're plea bargained. Yeah, I was going to say pre-negotiated, but yeah, plea bargained. So I assume the judge has some, or prosecutors have some say in what these conditions are that the people sort of sign off on in order to not go to jail, or not go to trial for that matter. So, and I just know anecdotally that some of them are, for the cases, and I'm not going to get into specifics, seem to be overly harder for people to adhere to, and maybe not necessarily related to the crime they committed, but just seem to be standard protocol, and I guess your commission hasn't really looked at or unable to affect that change. But I guess overall, the graph you showed that property crime has been down as a trend, violent crime was up locally in Alaska. Is violent crime down nationally, and Alaska is going against that trend for the same time frame that you showed us since 76 to now? Is nationally violent crime down, and Alaska is bucking that trend?
Through the chair, Representative Wold, the big trend nationally since the 90s has been really all crime down. There are exceptions for certain, like, large municipalities that you may have heard about. There seems to be a difference there.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. If you can wait in case there's time left before 3 o'clock, if there's follow-up questions, and next we'd ask Quinlan Steiner to come forward. Please go ahead and state your name and your position, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I am the public defender for the state of Alaska and the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I'm also a member of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission and have been so since the beginning. I was asked here to present, and I don't have a presentation prepared, but what defense lawyers and public defenders are seeing as we've gone through this process. So I've talked to or canvassed the state to sort of get a picture of what's going on, and it's a fairly consistent picture. So I'll tell you what people are saying, and I'll tell you what I know based upon some of the presentations that I've seen before the Criminal Justice Commission, and I'm happy to take questions along the way. I'd like to start with bail. One of the things that we've seen is that our clients are getting out at larger rates and succeeding, not just getting out. This connection between the release and the PEDs seems to be producing success for our clients, and there seems to be some data both suggesting that and indicating, I think, quite strongly that that's the case. One of the key factors that we noticed and heard a presentation on was that there was a concern about arrest and rearrest and catch and release. And the data that we saw at the meeting on Monday was remarkably consistent over the years. The number of rearrests are not increasing. They didn't increase prior to criminal justice reform. They didn't increase after criminal justice reform or in the several iterations afterwards. one thing that I find compelling about that is it appears that clients are being released at higher rates, but those incidents of rearrest are not increasing, and that may be an indicator that the rate is in fact declining, or at least the release decisions are not producing this high rearrest rate that people have been concerned about.
And for those that have questions about the research he's referring to, you're going to hear that on Friday.
Wish I had it all with me to present to you, but that's other people's data. And there's also data indicating, and this is not complete, that the arrests for new criminal offenses may be declining at the same time. But again, that was data that was referred to as just not complete. It's promising data, but it isn't complete and ready to rely on. But the indicators and what people are seeing seem to be indicating that. People are getting out. They're getting out and succeeding. And this raises a question, I think, that Representative Ledoux referenced. What happens when people are in jail and remain in jail and then get sentenced? And one of the concerns was, in throughout the reform, was people who are detained and then sentenced have longer sentences relative to those who are released. One of the reasons that may be is people who are released have an opportunity to work and succeed and show that success to the judge later at sentencing, and it produces shorter sentences. Again, that's all tied to success and recidivism. Going on to parole and probation, this is an area where we've seen sort of a radical shift in how parole and probation and clients are essentially working together. It was described to me as clients, when they do get into violation status, being more in a problem-solving collaboration with probation officers when it finally gets to that point. And that really is likely the response of earned compliance credits and the administrative sanctions and rewards that precede it. So somebody who's not succeeding on parole or probation might be first confronted with a sanction, or if they are, they're presented with a reward. That's new as a requirement. Some POs have done that in the past, not all. And then the next step in the process might be an actual violation. But through that process, there's a definable sort of goal that's short and measurable and guaranteed if you can do it, which is to not get in trouble, not violate your parole or probation within 30 days. And it's that guarantee that lawyers are reporting are inspiring clients to actually work their best to maintain compliance. And success is building on success. And so when you do see a violation status, eventually there is a more collaborative problem-solving approach that's being seen. And with the technical violations being short-term, there's very little litigation related to this. As was described earlier, when you had under the old system, it was these violations were often held in abeyance and all filed as a single petition. So there was very little response formally. And then when there was, it was fairly substantial periods of jail were at stake. And so you saw much more litigation and longer resolutions times. This whole system is built on immediate responses to conduct, both positive and negative, right from the get-go, and then builds on that so that they are immediate and proportional. And that appears to be showing some success. And that's what the data is indicating about higher compliance rates and discharge rates. And this kind of leads into the most encouraging data that I think exists, and that's recidivism rates. Corrections has produced recidivism data that's showing that it is going down. Now, it was going down prior to reform, but it continues to go down. The most recent release cohort was 2015. Recidivism data for these purposes is measured on a three-year time frame. So much of that recidivism data is measured from 2016, 2017, and 2018, which is post-reform supervision. That rate is continuing to decline, which was ultimately what the commission was aiming for, which was reduced recidivism rates, and we appear to be seeing that. But subsequent years, and certainly the next year release cohort for 2016, will almost exclusively be supervised and released under reform measures and policies. So those are really the things that we're seeing, the positive things we're seeing. There are certainly challenges along the way. The implementation has its ups and downs, and there are certain things that need to be worked on to make it more efficient and maximize some of these benefits. But in its essence, we see positive responses and positive indicators, both anecdotally and now with the data.
So I have one question, then I'll open it up to the rest of the committee. On the sanctions for technical violations that are filed with the court, the 3, 5, and 10 day limits that are part of the law now, how is that playing out in terms of petitions to revoke probation, and how does that compare to what you saw before the 3, 5, and 10 day sanctions? And these are for called technical violations as opposed to new crime violations.
Prior to reform, what you saw is more litigation because there was more at stake. There was more contested adjudications and more litigation that related to it. What you're seeing now is very little of that. The penalties are so short that the response is there's very little defense often to these technical violations. It was either a UA that was positive or failing to make an appointment. And with so little at stake, there's often admissions and moving forward immediately with no litigation. But that's also where the collaboration comes in. It becomes then an attempt to how do you move forward? The discussion is not did the violation occur? The discussion is how do you move forward for success? And then, of course, if it's not working and the sanctions ramp up, by the fourth one, you've essentially separated the individuals who can succeed under that model from those that are having more trouble, and then more stiff measures are available to the court and the parole office.
Representative Ledoux.
So, Mr. Steiner, if recidivism was going down before the passage of Senate Bill 91, how do we know that its continued fall had anything to do with Senate Bill 91? I mean, conceivably, couldn't it have gone down even further without Senate Bill 91? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what the data is that says that the continuing decline is as a result of Senate Bill 91.
I think that's difficult to say. I don't think you can strictly make that conclusion off of this data. The causation of all of this is really difficult to establish. Correlation is what you can see, and what'll be worth looking at is what is the rate of decline. It started down, I think, about 2 to 3 years before the 15 cohort, which would have included a cohort that wasn't under the supervision, but it appears that it's still declining and possibly steeper, but you'd need more data to establish a trend to even make a guess about that question.
So I guess that So I guess that really means that we can't attribute the decline of recidivism to Senate Bill 91.
Not at this time. I don't think you can make a judgment about that.
Thank
either
you.
Way.
Any other questions, Representative Eastman?
Thank you, through the chair. I noted that you mentioned that your I don't know if clients is the right word, but those in the system are seeing success. And I was just wondering if you could sort of help us flesh that out. What do you mean when you say that they're seeing success?
Through the chair, by that I mean that they are released, they are not getting rearrested, and they may be progressing in a treatment or a rehabilitative program or obtaining employment or maintaining employment, staying in their home, maintaining contacts with their family. One of the concerns about putting somebody in jail pre-trial, even for short periods of time, was it would separate them from that. It didn't take too many days before somebody might lose their job, and from that you have the cascading effect of potentially loss of housing and separation from family. And it's those indicators that maintaining those contacts and that network is associated with increased success. That's
thank
what
you.
I'm describing.
And follow up,
Representative Eastman.
I appreciate that, and that I think that matches what I was hoping you meant by success. I'm also reflecting on the presentation we just got. I think you probably saw most of that was the last three slides particularly, which talk about the crime rate, violent crime, rape, and property crime. And for the last few years, according to these stats, all those rates are up. So I'm curious, how do you reconcile that recidivism is down and success is being found for those who have been in the system, and yet from the public's perspective, those who are the victims, the crimes are going up and up each year since, last few years.
Through the chair. I think the crime rate started to trend up a number of years before the reform came into place. And when you look at the rearrest data, the rearrest numbers haven't changed throughout that entire period. And in discussion of this particular question following the meeting, one, I think, plausible and probable explanation is there's just the crime rate is increasing as a result of new people coming into the system and committing crimes, more or less, not for the first time, but new into the system. It's not rearrest. But it goes back to that question of what caused it to go up in the first place. And that is, again, causation is so difficult to establish. There are many ideas that have been discussed. One of the primary ones has been the association of increased opioid addiction layered onto an existing problem with methamphetamines and alcohol. Those appear to remain an issue and always have been, as is individuals with behavioral health needs that come into contact with the system. Those have not gone away. It really is addressing all of it that would be necessary to go at that particular.
Paul?
One more question, and then I want to see if anybody else has other questions or whether we want to stay a little longer. I know we're up on 3
Thank
o'clock.
You.
So.
Yeah, final question for you and through the chair. So I'm curious from where you sit, anecdotally, if you don't have any specific numbers, those new arrests that we're talking about, from what you're seeing, are those mostly those who are in-state becoming new arrests, or are you seeing, I think, some of the anecdotes we've heard of those who say, hey, looks like it's not so bad to be a criminal in Alaska, I think I'm going to move to Alaska, and are those the population that are being initially or new arrests that you're talking about?
Through the chair, we don't track that, and I haven't heard anecdotal stories either way. It hasn't come up. We have a very limited ability to track any data about our clients in particular. They're appointed, they're assigned to us, and that's really the extent of what we know generally as a data collection. We'll know more individually. If I looked at a file, I could tell much more. But.
Does the committee want to stay for a few more minutes to have more follow-up questions? Do we want to
leave?
representative. Does anybody want to stay longer, or should we conclude for the day?
One question, clarification, I guess.
Sure, go ahead and represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Mr. Steiner, and we hear we've heard a lot of sort of claims over the last few years, both pre and post SB 91. These graphs show that crime went on the increase around 2014, pretty steadily up till 2017, which is where your last graph went, and now we're in 2019. So I don't know what the last 2 years look like. But I guess my question is, as far as letting people out on pretrial with some extent based on the pretrial assessment tool, and the percentage of them that are, say, not coming back for trial and the percentage that are, any stories or facts or data we hear about this, according to you guys and Mr. DiPietro, we don't really have that data yet, and that has yet to come out. It will come out in June. Is that correct?
Well, there's some data that was produced by the university that addressed that very question. It was the rearrest data. So the number of rearrests didn't change for a number of years, and they were measuring whether or not somebody was rearrested within 7 days. So you're arrested where you're arrested again in 7 days. That didn't change throughout. From years before, throughout the reform and post-reform, even with the period of change. And they measured that out at least to 180 days, and it never changed. The rearrest data isn't changing at all. What's encouraging about that is, A, whatever is done in the bail system hasn't caused an increase in rearrest, but it appears that more people are being released, and which would indicate that the tool and the changes were made were doing exactly what they were supposed to do, which is permit greater release opportunities without creating any enhanced public safety risk, because the de-emphasis on monetary bail has allowed people who were low risk but just simply couldn't get out of jail because they didn't have money, they're being released, and according to this, apparently succeeding. And that's one of the things about bail that's going on now, is there's more discussion about whether or not somebody can meet the bail requirements when they are imposed, which was prohibited before. In subsequent hearings, you couldn't simply get a hearing to say, unable to afford this bail, which was critical because bail itself, monetary bail, is, and the amount that's set is supposed to be taken into account, because the monetary bail itself, relative to somebody's ability to pay it, legally is supposed to be factored in. But when you made a proposal and then later found out you didn't have access to those assets, the structure prevented an adequate fleshing of that question out. And so now it's back on the table to discuss, you know, what is the appropriate bail and how is that going to impact release. And this indicates to me you're seeing the benefits of that. People are being released not simply because of money, but because of risk as determined by the tool and the judge in the courtroom.
Last follow-up.
Go ahead, Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is that because there's not any more crimes being committed, that these individuals being released on bail aren't committing crime, or aren't getting caught anyways, but aren't committing crime, and is them showing up for trial, is that even in the metric, or is that something else you're looking at to see if they quote-unquote skip bail?
That is in the metric. There is some indication that might be rising a little bit, but it's hard to say. Much like the new criminal arrest data, it looks like it's producing this, but it's incomplete data. But that is one of the things that's being looked at as well. What is, you know, the rate of failure to appear, and why is it changing? That one can have some other factors that should be looked at to determine what's influencing that, because it's possible that it were being handled in a different way, but that would need to be determined.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Kopp, you've got a question? Go ahead.
It's more of just a comment on the graphs.
Okay.
Hold it.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So there is a striking difference between the admissions graph and the crime rate trend graph. I just wanted to comment on that, because the admissions are actual arrests, and if you'll notice, they disagree strongly with the crime rates. And what a lot of people don't understand is that crime rates are reported crime rates. They're the reports that come in. They're not verify they weren't necessarily arrests and convictions made their reports. For example, public safety goes to hundreds of calls of reported assaults. When you get there, there's nobody there. The fight already had, there's nobody gone or there's nobody talking. That's the other thing is that when you look at hard data of what is our system actually dealing with, you do have to look at what's going on in the court system. What was the cases with evidence that prosecutors brought forward? And so just to show you, in 15, it actually shows, coming out of 14, shows admissions going down for violent crime. And it pretty much has stayed flat here for quite a while, for the last 3 years. On the admissions chart again, post Senate Bill 54, when we increased accountability for nonviolent offenses, you do see an immediate increase of nonviolent offenders, which is what it should have been after we passed that bill. Again, I just wanted to say there's a difference between reported offenses and people actually being prosecuted, charged, and going to prison. And it's very hard, and Quinlan touched on this, but there's many factors that are hard to explain why a rate may go up. We know beginning in 15 we had a scourge of opioid that was unrelated to any legislation, and it powered us right through the last 3 or 4 years. And it doesn't matter what our system looks like for fine-tuning the criminal law, we are going to see a surge in people coming into the system because of out-of-control opioid issues that law enforcement has been wrestling with. Those things are unrelated to legislation. We certainly have responded trying to get that reined in. But I would just say, I didn't mean to just go off, but I would like to know what Quinlan's.
I was giving you a chance for comments as opposed to questions.
Quinlan's, do you have any response to that?
With regard specifically to the opioid.
To anything I said.
it's very difficult to determine causation, but there does appear to be an increase at the same time people were seeing more cases involving opioids. But what never went away was methamphetamines, alcohol, and behavioral health concerns that would bring people into contact with the system.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today. I'm going to close invited testimony. We will now adjourn for the day. I'd like to thank today's speakers for joining us. Our next meeting is Friday, March 8th at 1:30, following the Judiciary Finance Committee Subcommittee, our Judiciary Finance Subcommittee meeting, where I think we're going to be hearing about the court's budget. When we resume on Friday, we're going to be hearing from two professors from UAA that are going to be talking about a lot of the data that we've been talking about, including the rearrest study that Mr. Steiner was referencing. So it'll be more on the data side. And with that, we will adjourn. It is now 3:08 p.m.